The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Advertising Corporation and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found in this Washington Times Community column, Forbidden Siegel Talk.
It's time now for The Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you think Christians are too closed-minded. Well, my friend, the purpose of an open mind is to examine data, study facts, draw a conclusion, and then eventually close your mind. We do this with practically everything. You are probably not open-minded about whether or not the Earth rotates around the sun, and yet, when it comes to what is popular, when it comes to what is fashionable, when it comes to what is politically correct, when it comes to taking a position which might cause your friends to look at you in a not-so-positive light, how open are you? How much are you willing to study those stubborn little critters called facts? Take a look, for example, at the issue of same-sex marriage. Now look, regardless of how one feels about that issue, let's be honest. Back in the late 60s and early 70s, when people were first coming out of the closet, or when liberals in Hollywood were first defending gays, or directors in Hollywood were first challenging America's view of homosexuality, right or wrong, that took some courage. It did, absolutely it did. But today the tide has changed. Although the majority may still have a conservative view, they generally keep it hidden, out of fear of being called a homophobe or a racist or maybe even something worse. In Hollywood, on our college campuses, in the media, the popular position is to accept same-sex marriage. It no longer takes courage to affirm the homosexual lifestyle. In fact, if I dare say, it would take a little courage to disagree with the affirmation. Can you just imagine a secular college professor today standing up in the classroom teaching that he believes homosexuality is a learned behavior? Come on, he'd lose his job faster than you could say free speech or academic freedom. I mean, who are we kidding? Can you imagine an actor or screenwriter pitching a project in Hollywood that shows both sides? Forget which side. It just shows both sides. A discussion, both sides of the gay issue, without painting the conservatives with horns and a tail. They'd drive him out on a rail. Hey, that rhymed. Tail, rail, see how I did that? But with or without courage, a far bigger question needs to be asked. What is right for our children? What is right for our families? What is right for our country? And should this be something decided by the Supreme Court, or decided by a popular vote from our democratic republic? At least we used to be a democratic republic. Well, my friend, frankly, it no longer matters how you feel. It doesn't matter what you believe. Doesn't matter who you think should decide, because it is going to be decided by the court. Even if they throw it back to the states, it will be interpreted as a right which the court gave the states. Let me tell you something. It was never the intention of our forefathers to grant the Supreme Court that much power. Nowhere in the Constitution does it say that it's the purpose of the Supreme Court to interpret the Constitution. Later on in today's show, I'll tell you how that dangerous precedent started historically. But for now, on the subject of same-sex marriage itself, certainly, we've talked about this issue before. Certainly, we talked about the related issue of judicial activism before. So why talk about it again today? Well, I'll tell you, it's not because I want to. Believe me, trust me, I can name about 100 issues I'd rather discuss. But sick and tired as I may be, the court is about to decide. And the issue is therefore impossible to duck. Proper or not, the Supreme Court will make this decision. The only say that we, the citizens, have, the only say that we, the public, have, is in the form of prayer. The Bible tells us in 1 Timothy to pray for kings in high places. That way we can live a peaceful life, and a peaceful life is more conducive to the spreading of the gospel. That is what Paul shares with Timothy. Well, the Supreme Court is kind of like a king in a high place. It's kind of like a monarchy. Technically, it's an oligarchy. 9 people with lifetime appointments, 9 people who can never be voted out of office will be making a crucial decision for us. We may as well pray. It's all we have left. It's all we can do. Well, we can do a little more, I guess. We can speak out. Well, freedom of speech is still legal in this country. In the wake of so many current riveting news events like Benghazi, the IRS, the Verizon Wireless cooperation with our government, the pressure our government is putting on news organizations like Fox or the Associated Press, not to mention the literal meltdown going on in the Middle East and countries like Syria and Turkey and Egypt, well, some have forgotten what else lurks in America's horizon. The question of same-sex marriage finally made its way to our Supreme Court. We have not heard as much about this issue lately because the skilled attorneys from both camps have finished their passionate pleas and returned home. 9 U.S. Supreme Court justices are now reflecting upon the various arguments thrown their direction. So at the moment, we're experiencing still waters, and stormy waves may have appeared to be far off on the horizon, but my friend, June has finally arrived, and soon a decision will be made. Could be days, could be just weeks. Actually, 2 different but related laws are being considered simultaneously. First, the Defense of Marriage Act in 1996, which grants states the rights to refuse recognition of same-sex marriage should a couple relocate from a former state that did not allow the union. DOMA also offers a definition of marriage at the federal level, and I'm reading the official definition. In determining the meaning of any act of Congress or of any ruling, regulation, or interpretation of the various administrative bureaus and agencies of the United States, the word marriage means only a legal union between one man and one woman as husband and wife, and the word spouse refers only to a person of the opposite sex who is husband or a wife. Now, DOMA was signed into law by Bill Clinton, who has since evolved to the point where he no longer agrees with his own law. I've evolved. It looks like I've evolved on this one. And such evolution has been recently shared by President Obama, who refused to defend DOMA, and several Johnny-come-lately Republican candidates. The other case, of course, is the appeal of California's infamous Proposition 8. This one has a backstory that could rival any soap opera or reality show. At first, the will of the people got struck down when courts overturned a new law springing to life from Proposition 22. A successful 2000 ballot measure, Prop 22 defined marriage as a union between a man and a woman. The California Supreme Court felt it knew better and ruled the law as unconstitutional. So, people tried again with Proposition 8. The goal this time was far more ambitious. They decided to amend the California Constitution itself. After all, no judge can rule something unconstitutional if it's actually in the Constitution, right? Whoa, not so fast. The new law was also struck down because supposedly California's amended Constitution violates our federal Constitution. Okay, whatever the outcome, don't hold your breath waiting for this issue to go away. Strong opinions and emotions will remain on both sides of the aisle. The Supreme Court could no more end a debate on same-sex marriage than 1973's Roe v. Wade made abortion discussions disappear. Actually, that's not such a bad thing. One should never be in a hurry to shut down an important debate. In that vein, perhaps it would be best to back up and study the same-sex issue a little more closely. What follows today on today's radio show is a series of responses to certain questions or statements, all of which I have heard in real conversations, and believe me, I've had many conversations. The objective is to inspire and stimulate further dialogue in a friendly atmosphere. I cannot say that clearly enough. Cordial discussion seems to be missing today. It's time to put away worthless mudslinging. It's time to put away attempts to silence opposing views. Well, certainly weak arguments have been heard from both sides. Nevertheless, today's radio show takes one side. It's probably no spoiler alert to admit right up front that I'm going to be speaking on behalf of traditional marriage, hopefully presenting a better case than people are used to hearing, all the while offering empathy for the side I respectfully disagree with. My goal is to not only discuss the issue compassionately, but legally, intellectually, and even psychologically. And we'll begin by addressing people who think evangelical Christians and other conservatives are their enemies. They say, isn't it important to speak against hate? Those who are against same-sex marriage are filled with hate, aren't they? Well, my friend, with all due respect, that's quite a sweeping generalization. Have you met and conversed with every single person opposed to same-sex marriage? Have you allowed them to speak for themselves, or are you letting others filter and restate their opinions? And how exactly are you defining hate? I respect your desire to be loving, but please be careful here. Stop, take a deep breath, and notice the subtlety of what's going on. Otherwise, you may find yourself guilty of the same kinds of bigotry you claim to be against. Before pulling words such as compassion or tolerance out of the arsenal, please put yourself under the microscope of these very words. Can you show compassion and tolerance for people who have a view of homosexuality contrary to your own? Yeah, but Bob, disapproving of homosexuality is like disapproving of an entire race because gay people were born that way. Actually, nothing of the sort has ever been proved. This notion will be challenged later on in today's program. But for now, even if you disagree with me, viewing sexuality as different from race or skin color isn't really that far of a stretch, is it? I know dedicated liberals are quick to make this comparison by couching the debate under headings such as equality or civil rights. They often forget how many African Americans and Latinos resist the alleged parallel. Did you know that 70% of California's African American voters voted in favor of Proposition 8? And a little more than half of California's Hispanic voters joined them. Of course, they then went ahead and voted for a man who expressed disagreement with Prop 8, Obama. But that inconsistency will be saved for another time. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show.
As if you haven't figured it out by now, Bob is mildly opinionated about the ultimate issues of life. But Bob also respects the opinions of others. To offer your own viewpoint or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, give us a call at 1-888-344-1170. 1-888-344-1170. You can also reach Bob through Facebook, Twitter, or questions at bobsiegel.net.
Discussing the mildly controversial view of same-sex marriage. Before we went to the break, I talked about the fact that liberals like to couch this as a civil rights issue, and yet so many African Americans and Latinos in California actually voted for Proposition 8. Reverend William Owens, head of the Coalition of African American Pastors, is himself a civil rights activist. He had this to say about the comparison between gay rights and the African-American plight. He said, "Every morning I wake up, I look in the mirror and I see a black man, and there is absolutely nothing I can do to change the color of my skin. They are not suffering what we suffered, and I sympathize with people who face discrimination. Every person should be treated with dignity and respect, but what they're going through does not compare to what we went through." Owens went on to say that changing the definition of America will be, quote-unquote, devastating to all families. So you think, well, Bob, even if the comparison with race breaks down, you are still suppressing the rights of gay people. Shouldn't they be allowed to marry? Nobody says they can't. Who says they can't? In fact, gay churches and other liberal churches have been performing homosexual weddings for years. All we ask is that they not force the rest of us to change our own definition of marriage. If they are entitled to their view of marriage, we are also entitled to ours. Yeah, but Bob, in most states, a gay marriage isn't recognized legally. That's true, but many who oppose changing the definition of marriage still support civil unions. A lot of states have civil unions or domestic partnerships, and we're probably on the road to all having them in time. With such an ideal scenario, there would be no financial benefit denied and no hospital visitation suppressed. So legally, homosexual couples would have the same rights, and religiously, depending upon the church, they have the affirmation of marriage. I honestly appreciate your desire to be fair and compassionate. I really do. But please think about this for a moment. If gay couples can already be married by choosing from a wide array of liberal churches, if they can also have legal civil unions, if they decide to then call themselves married, as they have been doing for many decades, and if nobody is passing any law against their free speech to describe their relationship any way they choose, what possible reason remains for demanding that the entire country change its definition of marriage other than to insist on affirmation from people who have a right to their own opinion about varying lifestyles? Now, one of the greatest challenges from proponents of same-sex marriage comes in the form of a question designed to garner affirmation response from conservative, liberal, and libertarian alike. They say, how exactly does it hurt your own marriage or your own family if two same-sex people get married? All right, well, look, on its surface, this is a fair question. Does another person's marriage have any direct impact on your own? No, of course not. But we're missing a much bigger point. As Americans, our lives, our marriages, and our families do not exist in isolation. We are profoundly influenced by the direction of society as a whole. As a pastor, I have counseled many lesbians and male homosexuals. I'm quite sympathetic to their plight. I understand their desire to be married and happy like everyone else. At the same time, I would be lying if I said that gay marriage does not affect the rest of us. The truth is there are many such effects, and it's time to list them. First of all, the effect on your children. Your children may live in a stable, two-parent, heterosexual home, but you're only one of many influences in your child's life. Even without the legalization of same-sex marriage in various states, candid discussion of homosexuality in the public school system has already been a part of a growing agenda. Proposition 8 advocates warned that if gay marriage remained the law of the land, schools might be forced to talk improvingly about the subject in sex ed and other such classes. Opponents of Prop 8 replied swiftly by painting conservatives as a group of paranoid fearmongers. In a television ad back in those days, Jack O'Donnell, the state superintendent of public instruction, spoke with considerable passion. He said, Prop 8 has nothing to do with schools or kids. Our schools are not required to teach anything about marriage, and using kids to lie about that is shameful. Well, of course, everything O'Connell said was technically true. Yeah, technically true. Prop 8 did not have anything to do with schools, but people were understandably worried about a slippery slope. Evidently, we didn't even need the slope. In 2011, a new California law launched a politically correct viewpoint of homosexuality This rocket is fast on its way to school curriculum, regardless of Proposition 8's future. Senate Bill 48 was signed into law by Governor Jerry Brown. And while including some mandates that nobody should disagree with, such as a study of the role and contributions of Native Americans, African Americans, Mexican Americans, Asian Americans, Pacific Islanders, European Americans, the law also insists that history teaching include lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender Americans. Now, people will argue that the latest law is not about marriage, since its emphasis is merely on the contributions of gay people in history. But such hair-splitting conveniently avoids the deeper concern, indoctrination regarding the same-sex lifestyle, period. We can assert that mentioning gay people in history does not automatically translate into approval of a gay lifestyle, but assuming naive students would not pick up exactly that interpretation is a stretch of the imagination. Their own trusted teacher is going out of the way to mention sexual orientations of people involved with positive historical events. No disclaimer is allowed. Nobody will hear a teacher add, "Well, although I personally do not believe homosexuality is appropriate behavior, this is still an interesting historical anecdote to study." No, you see, that kind of qualification is also taboo under the same law, SB 48, which, quote unquote, prohibits instruction or school-sponsored activities that reflect adversely upon persons because of their race or ethnicity, gender, religion, disability, nationality, and sexual orientation. Legalization of gay marriage will give this indoctrination agenda even more teeth. You still believe these developments will not affect your child directly? And then there's the effect not only on your own children, there's the effect on other people's children. For years, we have admitted as a society that children are better off in a two-parent home. Now relax. Stop clutching your chest. I'm aware of the exceptions. Yes, of course, there are loving single parents who have done a wonderful job. Let me say that again. There are loving, many, many loving single parents who have done a wonderful job, okay? And yes, of course, there are many unhealthy, dysfunctional two-parent families, but pointing out exceptions to the rule ignores the rule itself, which is kind of a big elephant in the room. Ideally, children need a healthy father and a healthy mother. They need both because men and women are different, and each one has different things to offer in a child's upbringing. We used to feel free to admit this rather obvious truth. Unfortunately, the need to be accepted by friends in a politically correct world results in people shoving truth under the rug. The more children are raised by fathers and mothers together, the better we will be as a society. You know that. I know that. Everybody knows that. Now, here's what's interesting. Many self-described liberals insist we need diversity of genders on the Supreme Court because women will bring a different perspective. And yet, when these same people are asked about males and females together as role models for children in the family, they suddenly switch gears. Study on ancient Rome and other cultures show that when the family breaks down, the entire country breaks down. But then, history always provides 20/20 hindsight.
Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle, so when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for WNS Electric Incorporated, license number 480539, WNS Electric. If you think same-sex marriage will not affect us as Americans in many, many ways, think again. The purpose today on The Bob Siegel Show is to inspire a respectful discussion. But before we go on with that discussion, I want to talk a little bit about next week's show. Next week will be a very special edition of The Bob Siegel Show. I will have the honor of interviewing the brilliant and talented actor Michael Moriarty. Most people remember him from the first 4 years of television's Law and Order. He played the DA Benjamin Stone, but he's been in so much more. Pale Rider with Clint Eastwood, the television miniseries Holocaust. He has won the Emmy, the Tony, and the Golden Globe. He also writes a column now for Washington Times Communities, which is how his paths crossed with mine. We will talk with him about his impressive acting career and also his very interesting political viewpoints. Michael Moriarty next week on The Bob Siegel Show. But this week on The Bob Siegel Show, the effects of same-sex marriage. And we move on now to the legal effect. Is legalized same-sex marriage the final objective for militant gay activists? Or is it instead another step along the road to eventually silencing dissenting opinion? Now, I do want to be fair here. Militant gay activists do not speak for all homosexuals. Many gay people simply wish to be left alone. Others, such as openly lesbian radio talk show host Tammy Bruce, bravely challenge the militant gay agenda and get in trouble by gay peers for doing so. She wrote a book called The New Thought Police. Very brave woman. Likewise, one radio talk show host like myself can't claim to speak for all conservatives. But I'll tell you something, and I mean this sincerely. If it were a given that legalized gay marriage would settle all remaining legal discussions relating to homosexuality, if I thought the gay community would say, okay, we're now square, we've acquired all our rights, thanks, many of us would have less of a problem with it. Oh, sure, I would still have concerns, but I could live with them. Unfortunately, there is little evidence that the militant gay movement plans to embrace legalized marriage as a complete fruition of their goals. This latest sought-after right is only a small part of a much bigger agenda. With each new right, it becomes all the easier to obtain another. Much the way fighting for civil unions broke ground for full legal gay marriage in many states. That's what they used to say, just civil unions. That's all we ask for, just civil unions. That's what they said, but it wasn't enough. Because when human nature gets a taste of power, it's never enough. This is why it's important to look at more than a few photos of a movement. We should watch the entire film. The true militant gay agenda is to someday make it against the law to say that homosexuality is wrong. This goal has been openly, shamelessly stated for quite some time. I'm reading here from homosexual spokesperson Jeff Levy way back in 1987, something he said for the National Press Club in Washington. And he laid out the agenda fairly clearly. He said, "We are no longer seeking just a right to privacy and a protection from wrong. We also have a right, as heterosexual Americans already have, to see government and society affirm our lives." Well, those are interesting words. How do you insist that an entire society affirm something without challenging freedom of speech? What about those who cannot, in good conscience, affirm a homosexual lifestyle for religious reasons or maybe for other reasons? When one group of people demands affirmation, how does the First Amendment apply to everybody? At the moment, legal marriage is one kind of sought-after affirmation. Once accomplished, it only makes sense to insist on other kinds of affirmation. Activists have been smart enough to chip away at the legal and cultural wall one inch at a time. Marshall Kirk hammered out a viewpoint
blueprint for his ambitious gay agenda with some co-authors in the late 80s and early 90s. The plan was first published as a magazine article and lately expanded into a book called After the Ball, How America Will Conquer Its Hatred of Gays in the 1990s. Everybody should go to Amazon.com and order that book and read it. It's called After the Ball, How America Will Conquer Its Hatred of Gays in the 1990s. This manifesto, and it was a manifesto, was an open, strategic campaign to launch a patient, persistent, legal, and media movement. The goal was not only to obtain full legal rights for gays, but to also convince the country that criticism of the homosexual lifestyle is an archaic practice which our country needs to shed. This strategy included lovable gay characters on sitcoms who encounter old-fashioned, narrow-minded friends. In a November 1987 article in Guide magazine, Marshall Kirk wrote, "The visual media, film and television are plainly the most powerful image makers in Western civilization. The average American household watches over 7 hours of TV daily. Those hours open up a gateway into the private world of straights through which a Trojan horse might be passed." A Trojan horse. As far as desensitization is concerned, the medium is the message of normalcy. So far, gay Hollywood has provided our best covert weapon in the battle to desensitize the mainstream. Bit by bit, over the past 10 years, gay characters and gay themes have been introduced into TV programs and films, but this should be just the beginning of a major publicity blitz by Gay America. Interesting quote, but television was only one of their battlefields. In the midst of debates, the soldiers of this cause were to portray anyone who disagreed with homosexuality as some kind of hate monger, even if they knew the person wasn't hateful. They were to portray him that way. Anyway, here's another quote. "To be blunt, they must be vilified. We intend to make the anti-gays look so nasty that average Americans will want to dissociate themselves from such types." And some of the methods that Kirk prescribed in After the Ball should produce chills. Catch this. He says, "Our effect is achieved without reference to facts, logic, or proof." I want to read that again. It's so important. "Our effect is achieved without reference to facts, logic, or proof. Through repeated infralogical emotional conditioning, the person's beliefs can be altered whether he is conscious of the attack or not. Indeed, the more he is distracted by even specious surface arguments, the less conscious he will be of the true nature of the process. In short, jamming succeeds insofar as it inserts even the slightest doubt of shame into the previously held unalloyed beliefs regarding heterosexuality and homosexuality." I find that absolutely chilling. Such cultural battles go hand in hand with supporting legislation. The winds of change are blowing all over the world, and we'll talk about these winds of change when we return to the Bob Siegel Show.
Kids ask you questions about God and the Bible that you can't answer? Sign yourself or your child up for a class with lots of solid answers at educateforlife.org before someone else gives them the wrong answers. Are you tired of not knowing what to say when your friends and family ask you questions about God and the Bible? Get equipped by signing up for a class at educateforlife.org. When someone asks you, "How do you know the Bible's true?" do you say something like, "I just know it is"? If you're tired of giving lame answers, sign up for a class at educateforlife.org. when someone says that God isn't real, wouldn't it be fun to prove that he is? Quickly, like a verbal ninja? By using science and logic. Sign up for a class at educateforlife.org with Christian apologetics teacher Kevin Conover, and you'll learn how to do that. Educateforlife.org.
I said it before, and I'll say it again, and I'll mean it every time. If I thought that the legalization of gay marriage would end everything, that the gays would say, we've got all our rights, we're square, I would still disagree. I would still have some concerns, but I could live with it. Unfortunately, that's just a step in a much larger agenda to prohibit free speech, to make it against the law to speak against gay marriage. In our last segment, I proved that. I quoted from their agenda, from their own spokesman. If you missed that, go to my website, bobsiegel.net. The show will be posted at least by Tuesday. You can download it or stream it. But let me tell you now what's happening all over the world already, because in some countries, this is already the law. In Ireland, the Prohibition of Incitement to Hatred Act of 1989, it's been around a long time, forbids, quote unquote, incitement to hatred on account of race, religion, nationality, or sexual orientation. Now, of course, that's making the assumption that disagreeing with somebody means you hate them. That's quite an assumption. But this law, you should know, includes public speaking, broadcasts, and written materials. One would think that a hateful motive would be in the eye of the beholder, but not in Ireland. Violation of this law includes what they call insulting, and that actual word is used in the language of the law. I think our forefathers in America knew that free speech would sometimes sound insulting. If free speech was always going to be benign and friendly, why would it need to be protected? Similar laws exist in England, Norway, Canada, Sweden. America's fast on its way to embracing similar legislation under terms such as hate speech and hate crime. Congress passed a Hate Crimes Protective Act in 2009. Since violent crime is already punishable under the law, getting into the head of a person to interpret hate carves a thin line between hate crime legislation and hate speech legislation. Next time, we may just see a law about hate without any actual crime. Last year, a judge in New Jersey ruled against a Christian retreat house that had declined permission for a same-sex civil union ceremony to be conducted on its property. The judge said, and you're going to love this, the judge said the Constitution allows some intrusion into religious freedom to balance other important societal goals. Oh, yeah. Yeah, we need some intrusion into religious freedom. And that's so clear in our Constitution, isn't it? Many argue for same-sex marriage by employing the familiar phrase separation between church and state. They say, look, Christians can define marriage any way they want. In church, but out in the world, out in secular society, religion cannot dictate to the rest of us. All right, fine, fair enough. But lately, the separation does not seem to be working both ways, does it? If a judge can rule that a Christian retreat house must accommodate a gay wedding, even in a state like New Jersey, which does not currently recognize same-sex marriage anyway, just imagine what kinds of lawsuits will unfold should gay marriage be legally recognized in all 50 states. Rest assured, the right to same-sex marriage is not the only legal battle going on. The right to freedom of speech trails closely behind. Redefining marriage merely paves the way. And then there is the most controversial effect of all. We've done the effect on children. We've done the effect on legalities. Next, the psychological effect. Now, contrary to what you hear in the media, most conservative, or at least most high-profile conservatives, are actually compassionate when they discuss their concerns about same-sex marriage. However, this does not mean they are undeserving of criticism. Some of them dance around the issue to the point of incoherence. On one hand, they express a concern about children needing the benefit of a two-parent, two-gender upbringing. At the same time, they have bought into the notion that people are born gay. Consequently, if we're born gay, there's nothing wrong with homosexual feelings or actions. In short, they are willing to call gay marriage wrong, but they are unwilling to call homosexuality itself wrong. Let's be clear. We could use some clarity. If there is nothing wrong with homosexuality, either morally or psychologically, if there is nothing wrong with homosexuality, then it logically follows that there is nothing wrong with homosexual marriage either. And gay marriage advocates are correct in pointing out this glaring inconsistency to their conservative challengers. Unfortunately, internal consistency or lack thereof begs the more obvious question. Is there something wrong with homosexuality? There was a time when most psychologists and psychiatrists said yes. And I know you don't want to hear that. I get that. I understand. And look, their purpose at that time was not to make anyone feel unwarranted guilt, but they did believe homosexual feelings and actions were not normal to mentally healthy people. For that reason, encouraging a homosexual marriage would have been considered emotionally unhealthy as well. This was the widespread teaching of the American Psychiatric Association for many, many years, but the tide began to change in the early 70s. Many people are unaware of the circumstances which led to homosexuality being declassified as an emotional disorder by the APA in 1973. You may never have heard about the pressure from gay activists and gay psychiatrists who were involved in the meetings, or the counter push from those who felt differently. You should know that the discussions leading to the vote were political and instilled a good deal of fear. In fact, so extended was the pressure that only 1/3 of the ballots sent out were ever returned. Out of those returned, only 58% agreed to declassify homosexuality as a disorder. Get that? Just 58% out of the 1/3 returned. But today's spin concentrates on the bottom line that the vote, however it was done, chose to declassify homosexuality as a disorder in the DSM-3. Prior to this time, homosexuals not only sought help from psychologists, but also received healing. Dr. Charles Socorides, a psychiatrist and psychoanalyst who had successfully treated gays for more than 20 years, was a part of the APA. In his book, Overcoming Homosexuality, he claimed that the militant gay movement was responsible for the greatest medical hoax of the century. Although many gay people sincerely believe they cannot remember a time when they weren't attracted to the same sex, that does not necessarily mean that they were born homosexuals. Elizabeth Moberly, a research psychologist for Oxford and Cambridge, explains this in her book, Homosexuality, A New Christian Ethic, pointing out that people absorb their key influences of sexual orientation between the ages of 2 and 5, a time in life most of us would not remember anyway. Even molecular biologist Dean Hammer, who headed one of the early famous studies which sought to find genetic explanations, said, and I quote, "Our studies try to pinpoint the genetic factors, not to negate the psychosocial factors." It may someday be discovered that there are two types of homosexuality, a learned behavior and a genetic predisposition. In either case, the homosexual in all likelihood did not choose his or her sexual orientation and should not be blamed for inward feelings or impulses. Likewise, in either case, the acting out of such impulses would still be unnatural behavior. It's believed that one can be born with a predisposition toward alcoholism too, but would we encourage an alcoholic to drink? None of this means that homosexuals are bad people, but while today's gay activists point to themselves as victims for not being able to legally marry, they are unwilling to consider the fact that they may have been victimized in some other way through the subtleties of various emotional influences. Maybe something happened in their upbringings, which, through no fault of their own, produced homosexual impulses. If a person has such tendencies and is not sure whether they stem from genetics or environment, what's wrong with them seeking help from a counselor on the chance that it might be an acquired behavior? And why should the desire to reach out and offer healing to such an individual be interpreted as hatred? Yeah, but Bob, if homosexuality is really so unnatural, how come most people don't view it that way? Oh, I'm convinced that most people do. Maybe they have trouble admitting this because of today's political climate, which has been growing now for 4 decades. We'll talk about that when we return to the Bob Siegel Show.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out Bob's weekly column for Washington Times Communities. Bob is also a regular contributor for San Diego Rostra and San Diego Newsroom. And don't forget his website, www.bobsiegel.net, S-I-E-G-E-L, bobsiegel.net. Here, you can download past radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and get information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net.
If homosexuality is really viewed so unnaturally, how come most people don't view it that way? I think most people do. I think that because of today's growing political climate that's been growing for over four decades, they have trouble admitting this. Have you ever seen a sitcom where two men danced or one accidentally kissed another? Oh, we see it all the time. It's a common device. The audience laughs every time. In fact, they laugh hysterically. It's an easy, guaranteed laugh. Question, simple, obvious question, simple, blunt, childlike question. Why do people laugh? Why do the writers and producers obviously intend for people to laugh? Even if they think they're coming out with some message about accepting the lifestyle, they know people are going to laugh. Why? Why do they know that? If indeed they recognize the normality of same-sex interaction, they recognize that. What exactly strikes us as humorous? Centuries ago, the brilliant author Hans Christian Andersen illustrated the value of a simple childlike mind in his story, The Emperor's New Clothes. Two charlatan tailors, wanting to trick the king out of his fortune, fashioned a set of fine apparel. There was one stipulation: only intelligent people could see these clothes. Of course, the clothes didn't really exist, so nobody ever saw them, but nobody wanted to be thought unintelligent either. So they reasoned to themselves, well, if I can't see the clothes, the problem must be with me. After all, everyone else sees them. Oh, you remember the rest. At a grand parade, one small child tugged his mother's skirt and said, but Mommy, he's not wearing any clothes. Nakedness was once nakedness. Now is the result of two clever tailors. The word naked in relationship to the king was politically incorrect. Could this same tailor have visited the United States? Maybe what we need today is an innocent child, like the one in the fairy tale, some red-faced, nose-running kid who hasn't studied genetics, hasn't studied psychology, and hasn't had sensitivity training. All he knows is what he sees and feels. Maybe if something looks unnatural, it is unnatural. Maybe we all know the truth and are afraid to admit it. Maybe the king isn't wearing any clothes. Meanwhile, let's return to our original question. Should the Supreme Court be making this decision? Should the Supreme Court be legislating from the bench at all? I remember back in 2009 receiving a comment from an atheist regarding my op-ed piece for the San Diego Newsroom. In arguing about what our Constitution's Establishment Clause meant, he reacted to my statements about the original intent of our forefathers. I had said what the Constitution meant to them is what the Constitution means, period. My reader responded, totally hopelessly wrong. What the Constitution means is what the Supreme Court says it means, period. Regarding the minds of the likes of Thomas Jefferson may be within your abilities, but I'd like to see proof. Of course, Jefferson was in France anyway when they wrote the Constitution, but a lot of his ideas were incorporated, and he meant the forefathers, the peers of Jefferson. But I hope you're paying serious attention to this, because in my article I had mentioned that in the days of our forefathers, religious shrines were all over public land. That doesn't tell us anything about the minds of the forefathers. Neither do the diaries of these men. It's impossible to know from the actual words of James Madison how he felt about the often arbitrary, often emotional interpretation of the Supreme Court tells us everything we need to know about Madison and the others. The words of our forefathers and the actions of our forefathers do not explain their own words, but the nine justices appointed by politicians with biases and litmus tests do explain their words? Have we gone insane? To anyone who thinks the Supreme Court has a perfect, exclusively authoritative, unchecked understanding of our Constitution, I have just three words for you. Dred Scott decision, where the wise, insightful, legal scholars ruled that African slaves were property. Still care to point out that court is a superior unquestioned power? Newsflash, nowhere in the Constitution does it say that the Supreme Court interprets the Constitution. Let me say that again. Nowhere in the Constitution does it say that the Supreme Court interprets the Constitution. Nowhere. Don't bother looking. Well, go ahead. Look, you won't find it. The purpose of the Supreme Court is not to interpret the Constitution. The purpose of the Supreme Court is to enforce the Constitution, to apply the Constitution. In all likelihood, many listeners are raising their eyebrows about now, even fellow conservatives who sympathize with public reaction against judicial activism. Maybe what I'm saying sounds too good to be true, or too bizarre to be true. Certainly this position is out of the mainstream at our present time in history. If you asked most Americans, they would say it is indeed the job of the Supreme Court to interpret our founding documents. So would most lawyers, certainly a good many judges. Yet some legal scholars would agree with me. Others might answer delicately, as law professor and talk show host Hugh Hewitt did when I interviewed him as a guest on my radio show a few years ago. I asked him if the Constitution never intended for the Supreme Court to interpret. He answered, it can be so argued. You can still listen to that on my website. It was the Bob Siegel Show 42405. Throughout history, majority opinion has often been wrong. Most people of the world accepted slavery for the greater balance of history, including, once again, the Supreme Court itself, but I won't belabor that point. And so perhaps we would be well served to temporarily ignore public opinion and instead examine the testimony of facts from the past. The interpretation tradition began when Thomas Jefferson refused to install some justices John Adams had appointed before he left office. Since the judges were never inaugurated, Jefferson didn't feel obligated to use them. His government was sued in a landmark case called Marbury versus Madison, 1803. As you can see, our republic was very new at the time. Because this unusual situation had never come up in such high-level, complicated scenarios, litigation turned to the Supreme Court, which ordered Jefferson via his Secretary of State, James Madison, to appear before them and explain himself. Jefferson ignored them. Marbury, one of the justices spurned by Jefferson, referred to the Judiciary Act of 1789 as a basis for the court being able to issue such commands. Ironically, the court, after first showing sympathy to Marbury, pronounced a contradictory ruling. It decided that the Judiciary Act was unconstitutional because it gave the Supreme Court more power than the Constitution intended. So even though the justices were sympathetic to Marbury and insisted the law set up by Congress was on his side, they ultimately ruled against him by deeming that same act of Congress to be technically unconstitutional. Marbury, according to the high justices, should have started with a lower court rather than the ultimate court in the land, and therefore they could not issue the verdict that both they and he wanted. This decision was actually a political stroke of genius under the leadership of Chief Justice John Marshall, who found a way to lecture and chastise his rival Jefferson without giving the popular president an actual court order that he would certainly refuse to obey. In short, Marshall devised a clever strategy to save face by having his cake and eating it too. Nevertheless, in calling an act of Congress unconstitutional for giving too much power to the court, this landmark ruling established a tradition about the Supreme Court telling us what the Constitution intended. Gotta see the irony. Now here's the thing. Jefferson disagreed with the court's newfound powers, even though in this particular instance the ruling was personally convenient, as now he did not have to appoint the justices. Jefferson feared that if this understanding of judicial power were accepted, it would be, quote-unquote, placing us under the despotism of an oligarchy. If you don't believe the Supreme Court should have that much power and most people disagree with you, at least you're in good company. Thomas Jefferson. This is Bob Siegel, making the obvious obvious.
The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.